The talk is on the descent during wartime, and the subtitle is How I Came to Admire the Black Sheep of the Family. You see this on the third page of the handout is a from a newspaper front page of the Birmingham News on July 28, 1918. And the person on trial is William Denson. And I guess he was my second cousin, my first cousin once removed. I don't know how all that goes, but he is on trial for violation of the Espionage Act in federal court. And he's defended by four former justices of the Alabama Supreme Court. The main attorney was my grandfather, who's seated right here and also right there. He was the chief counsel for the defense. And then the others, he was a former associate justice. All the others were former chief justices. This is William Denson here, the defendant, and this is also him back here. And his father-in-law, Judge Dowdle, is here, and then Judge Weakley and Judge Tyson. So it was sort of a dream team defense team that came to defend him. So I want to talk about that, but first, on your handout, I want to mention some of the books that are there and comment on them, because these are books that I've read over the years, and they all apply to dissent during wartime. If you're just going to read one book, I would recommend Perilous Times. This is a book that's also you can get from Laissez-Faire. It goes from the very beginning during the formation of the country, the Alien and Sedition Acts, and goes all the way up to the present time. The author, Jeffrey Stone, was a former provost of the University of Chicago. He's a former dean of the Chicago Law School. But he also wrote one of the briefs in the Japanese internment cases, the Korematsu case. And so he's taken a very active interest in dissent during wartime, because the Japanese internment was not dissent, but it was wartime power exercised by Franklin Roosevelt to just issue an executive order to put all Japanese Americans in concentration camps. And I knew that he was a child at the time he was put in, became chancellor of AUM, a branch, part of Auburn University. And he remembers being in the concentration camp and how distraught his family was. They were loyal American citizens of Japanese descent, and they were placed in the internment concentration camp for the whole period of the war and suffered greatly. But let me just read a part of Jeffrey Stone's introduction to the situation, and I think he covers it very well. It is often said that dissent in wartime is disloyal. The claim puzzles civil libertarians who see a clear distinction. In their view, dissent in wartime can be the highest form of patriotism. Whether, when, or for how long, and on what terms to fight the war are among the most profound decisions a nation can encounter. A democratic society must debate these issues throughout the conflict. Dissent that questions the conduct and the morality of a war is, in this view, the very essence of responsible and courageous citizenship. At the same time, or you might say on the other hand, dissent can readily be cast as disloyal. A critic who argues that troops are poorly trained or that war is unjust must make a significant contribution to public discourse, but he also gives, quote, aid and comfort, end quote, to the enemy. The enemy is more likely to fight fiercely if it is confident and believes in the adversary divided and is uncertain. Public disagreement during a war can strengthen the enemy's resolve. War generates a powerful mass psychology. Emotions run high. Spies, saboteurs, and terrorists lurk around every corner. Our way of life is imperiled. Anything that increases the danger to our troops, our sons and daughters, is feared and despised. The thought that a loved one or a friend has put his life and limb at risk for an unworthy cause is intolerable. We are just. Our enemy is cruel, immoral, inhuman. Loyalty is the order of the day. In such an atmosphere, the line between dissent and disloyalty is elusive and often ignored. As we shall see, the United States has a long and unfortunate history of overreacting to the perceived dangers of wartime. Time and again, Americans have allowed fear and fury to get the better of them. Time and again, Americans have suppressed dissent, imprisoned and deported dissenters, and then later regretted their actions. This book is first and foremost about why this happens and how we can break the pattern as we look to the future. So his sympathies are clearly in favor of allowing dissent and protecting that dissent with the Constitution. Another book I recommend to you is Limits of Dissent, about Clement Van Landingham in the Civil War. And I might mention just before we get to that, the Alien and Sedition Acts that were passed by Adams administration during the quasi-French War are the things that caused the Alien and Sedition Acts, and it was a very vicious act used by the Adams administration against the Anti-Federalists and resulted in the famous Kentucky and Virginia resolutions by Madison and Jefferson for nullification. So the Alien and Sedition Act started from the very beginning of our country, so there's been a battle on this from the very beginning. During the war between the states, Clement Van Landingham was a congressman from Ohio. And in July of 1861, he made speech on the floor of Congress critical of Lincoln and the administration for the unconstitutional war that was going on. He was a real thorn in Lincoln's side, and they gerrymandered his district so that he was defeated. And he continued to make speeches during the war. He was from Ohio. He was a Democrat. He was not a Southern sympathizer. He simply felt that Lincoln was wrong in the war, and he was opposed to it. So there was a military district in Ohio, and they passed an ordinance making it illegal to make speeches against the administration. He continued to speak out, and one night at midnight they broke into his home, and officers arrested him, took him to a military camp, and tried him with a military court and sent him to prison. And he was not allowed to have a habeas corpus writ or to have any constitutional protection. Lincoln took charge of the sentencing and banned him from America. And he first went to the South and then went to Canada. And while he was in Canada, he was nominated to be governor of Ohio and ran and was defeated. But he continued to speak out and eventually came back to America and they let him alone. But this is a very good book if you want to see some of the things going on in the Civil War. The next big case, and I have a book, but it's a book, a series of trials, great trials in America. And this is about Ex parte Milligan. You'll see it listed there by Klaus. It's a very similar case to Van Landingham. He again was arrested by a military officer, tried by a military court where the civil courts were available, and he was sentenced to death. And his case got to the Supreme Court after the war had ended. Van Landingham's, he tried to appeal to the Supreme Court, and they didn't hear it, but the war was still going on. When Milligan appealed his case, the war was over. And this is one of the great decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. They reversed the conviction and said that the fact that a war was going on did not suspend the Constitution. It was just as effective during war as it was during peacetime. And you'll see during the trial of William Benson that the U.S. attorney is arguing that the Constitution is suspended during wartime. it's a great decision. It's been attacked over and over. But it's one of the great decisions of the Supreme Court. Another book I recommend to you is Lincoln's Wrath. It's a fairly new book, and is mainly about one trial. Lincoln took over about 300 newspapers, confiscated the presses, and put them out of business because they were critical of the war. And this is about one of those trials and shows you the fiercely unconstitutional acts that took place against the press. Another book I want to mention in the Spanish-American War is 12 Against Empire. The Anti-Imperialist in 1898-1900. These were 12 men who were classical liberals, and they were not from the left, of course. And they opposed the Spanish-American War primarily when they found out that the war was really about getting the Philippines. And there was one man that also recommended a book, Atkinson. Mr. Atkinson was one of the 12 mentioned here. He was from Boston. He was a merchant there. And he wrote letters and cards, about 100,000 of them, and addressed them personally to all the soldiers serving in the Philippines, and told them to mutiny and to just lay down their arms and not take part in the war. And there was no law to arrest him on, but they confiscated all of those cards and letters and did not allow them to be sent out of the United States. And it would be my opinion that his actions, Atkinson's actions of trying to cause mutiny, is what caused the passage of the Espionage Act during World War I, which we'll get to. But that's a very good book, and it's it shows how America is now becoming an empire and how they opposed it. Getting to World War I, this won't be anything to show up, but Opponents of War by Peterson and Feit is one of the best books on World War I and the dissent that was waged mainly by socialists. The laws that were passed during the First World War, and these all come up in the William Denson trial. The Selective Service Act was passed in May of 1917, and then the Espionage Act was passed in June of 1916, and then the Sedition Act was passed in May of 1918. So all three of those acts eventually went in place during World War I, and you had people that tried to avoid the draft, people that were arrested under the Espionage Act, and finally under the Sedition Act. Under the Espionage Act, it made it unlawful for you to try to encourage mutiny or to interfere with the operation of the military. And we'll get into the facts of the Denson case and show how that took place. There were 2,168 trials under the Espionage Act, and there was 1,055 were convicted and 1,113 not guilty, so it was a less than 50% rate of conviction. And it was because of that low rate of conviction in the Espionage Act that the Sedition Act was passed in May of 1918. And, of course, the trial of William Denson is in July of 1918, but he's charged under the Espionage Act, not the Sedition Act. But the thing that makes his case so volatile is that Eugene Debs was tried and convicted under the Sedition Act in June of 1918, just two or three weeks before Denson went on trial. So it was an inflammatory period. The International Socialist in 1890 labeled capitalism as the main cause of war, and tried to encourage all socialists throughout the world to avoid any war. And so nationalism and socialism came into direct conflict when World War I broke out. Some socialists objected to the war, and some fought for their countries. The International Workers of the World was a strong socialist union in America called the Wobblies, and many of them protested against the war, and that's how the ACLU got into protecting socialists from the government on their dissent. They were dissenting on the basis they wanted to destroy capitalism, and they thought that capitalism was causing the war. So that's sort of the whole anti-war ideas sort of in place were from socialists, and that's how the anti-war movement got such a bad name, in my opinion. In World War I, it was the leftists that were protesting, whereas in the Spanish-American War, it was classical liberals. Anyway, Eugene Debs was sentenced to 10 years in the penitentiary and in June of 1918, and he served 3 years. He received 1 million votes for president. And then the Sedition Act was finally repealed in 1920, and the Espionage Act stayed in place. One thing I wanted to mention, the George Creel's committee, the Committee on Public Information, I found a book at home, I didn't bring it, it's called The Four-Minute Men. And another one of my relatives was a Four-Minute Man, which was a propagandist for the war. And I've heard and read various descriptions of why they named it The Four-Minute Men, but this book tells the story about it. Is that back in 1918 at the movies, when they showed a movie, they would have to change the reels. And it took 4 minutes to change the reels. So the Committee on Public Information, George Creel, selected people in every community to go to the movie theater and give a speech during that intermission so you had a captive audience. And they gave 4 minute speeches in favor of the war. And this reached millions and millions of people. Sometimes they had to hear it over and over, but they were there to see the movie and then they had to listen to the pro-war speech. Let me mention this, the certain things during the World War I. That's when the government came down hard on the economy, nationalized the railroads, expanded the income tax to cover everybody at extremely high rates, passed the Food and Fuel Act of August 1917. Herbert Hoover took charge of that and learned about all of his pro-government activities at that time, managing the fixing prices. And created the War Industries Board with Bernard Baruch, handling price fixing and completely running the economy. And all that was the prelude to the New Deal. The next book is on World War II, A Trial on Trial. This was the Great Sedition Trial of 1944. I guess that's going to reflect a good bit. Lawrence Dennis and Maximilian St. George. Roosevelt was determined to prosecute somebody for sedition. So they put these people on trial under the Smith Act, which passed in 1940. And it was a complete debacle. Lawrence Dennis served as his own attorney. And the trial went on and on. Finally, a judge died, and they brought in another judge. And finally, the thing just sort of collapsed. But it's a good survey on dissent during World War II. And finally, in the Vietnam War, the book Secrets by Daniel Ellsberg, I highly recommend it to you. He's very active now in the dissent against this war, and he states that his great regret is that he did not dissent earlier in the Vietnam War. It's a courageous story. He talks about how he went to Vietnam as a soldier and was very much for the war. Then he came back and worked for the RAND Corporation, did research for the government officials, and he would see the reports and see that they were saying that the war couldn't be won, that we needed to get out. And then the officials would get up and all talk about how the war is going great. He gives the instance where he was with McNamara, and McNamara read this report about how things were so terrible, and then had a press conference and told everybody everything was going great. So he realized that the people were not being told the truth about the war and made the decision to release the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. And, of course, that went to trial, and the New York Times was sustained in the Supreme Court. And the trial was so unfair that the federal judge finally threw it out. As you will probably recall, the government agents broke into the psychiatrist's office of Ellsberg to try to steal the records to attack him with, and they were caught. And when the judge found out about that, he just threw the case out. But he's still a rather courageous dissenter. So with that that background, I'll get into the Denson trial. My first knowledge of William Denson was when I was a freshman in law school, and I was taking a course the second semester in appellate procedure. And the professor said we were going to study the trials and the appeals of a very brilliant but very eccentric lawyer from Birmingham named Wild Bill Denson. And so as I was walking out of the classroom, he called me aside and said, since we're going to be discussing Mr. Denson, is he any kin to you? And I said, oh, I've never heard of him. And so I went home and asked my father, who was a lawyer, and I said, did Edwin take a course on Wild Bill Denson? Is he any kin to us? He said, yes, but you don't need to know anything about him. So all information was cut off, and I never heard anything about him again until a cousin of mine in Texas sent me that from the cartoon about the trial, and I began to try to find out more about it. But my father did tell me a little about Wild Bill's father, and it's an old saying, I guess it's a Southern expression, that the acorn didn't fall too far from the tree. Wild Bill was very, very much like his father. But anyway, his father was born in 1846. His name was William Denson. He was the oldest brother of my grandfather. And he was a 17-year-old, I guess, when he joined the Confederate Army and fought in some of the really tough battles. And then after the Reconstruction ended in 1876, he ran for the Alabama legislature when Confederate soldiers could then hold office. And he must have taken part in the Grover-Cleveland campaign, because Cleveland appointed him the U.S. attorney for two different districts in Alabama. And finally, he ran for Congress and was elected in 1890. And his campaign promise was that if he was elected, the first thing he was going to do, and I'm going to tone this down a little bit, is that when he got to the Capitol steps, he was going to find the first damn Republican and kick his butt down the Capitol steps. And the legend is that he kept that campaign promise. And my grandfather, his youngest brother that he sort of looked after, was on the Alabama Supreme Court, and he had run statewide, and he was very embarrassed about his brother's language and rambunctious conduct. And so he wrote him a letter and told him to tone down his campaign, and his brother wrote him back. This is Wild Bill's daddy wrote him back and called him Nimmy. He said, Nimmy, what scares you is just fun to me. And so he didn't tone it down at all. So he served in Congress for 10 years and died in 1907. So he was not living at the time his son was put on trial. And I think that's one reason my grandfather represented him, because Wild Bill's father was not there to defend him. But I think one reason my father had a low opinion of Wild Bill is that the name William Denson is sort of a revered name in our family. And I'll tell you a little bit about the original ancestor that Wild Bill and his father were named for, was named William Denson. And he was born in London, and his father died when he was a year old, and so he came to America at age 17 in 1638, and financed his trip by making a contract with a Mr. Pitts in Virginia, who had a large plantation, and became what's called an indentured servant. He agreed to work for him for 7 years, I guess at either no wages or low wages and room and board. So here's a young teenager striking out on his own. He was a Quaker, and at that time, that's still within the period of the 30 Years' War that didn't end until 1648. So Quakers were very much discriminated against as dissenters in England. And the English Civil War was just 4 years away, so it was a time of great political turmoil. So I'm not sure exactly what all of his reasons for coming to America were. But he set out on his own, and as an indentured servant, came to this county in Virginia that did not discriminate against Quakers. He was eventually elected to the House of Burgesses in 1659. And I remember reading this 40 years ago in Williamsburg. There's a plaque about the House of Burgesses, and I guess this may have been the first House of Burgesses. But he was elected to that, and he eventually acquired one or more ships and used those ships to bring in more settlers, colonists, to Virginia. And the king rewarded him for that and gave him 450 acres of land, and he built a home, and the foundation's still there. But I went through William and Mary one time and tried to research this a little bit, and I found some petitions signed by his sons in the 1660 or 70. And they were protesting to the King of England that they were loyal colonists, and yet their German neighbors were not having to pay the tax. And I'm not sure why that was. But the thought came to me as I was sitting there in that library that Thomas Jefferson was a student there 100 years later, and maybe he read some of those petitions, and maybe it inspired him somewhat for the tax protests that went on in the American Revolution. But with that history of William Denson, my father felt that Wild Bill had disgraced the family name by being arrested and put on trial. And as you'll see, my father was, if we get into the trial, Wild Bill talks about him being a soldier in France getting ready to go into the trenches, my father was. So I don't know exactly why my father had a low opinion of Wild Bill, but that's some of the background. I'll read you one more interesting sidelight on Wild Bill. This is a book, Pilgrim in the Ruins, which is one of the biographies of Walker Percy. I've read several of these. Walker Percy is what I call a New South writer. I don't like his writings. Movie Goer is one. I don't know if you've ever read that. But anyway, Walker Percy's father and Wild Bill got into a duel. And this is, of course, the Percy's writing of this. But this will give you a little background on Wild Bill. Not that the practice of law was always a tame affair, even as late as the 1920s, so this would be after the trial. There was still something of a raw frontier edge to Birmingham. The carrying of pistols was not unheard of. In fact, even Leroy came close to shooting it out with another lawyer, a brilliant and intimidating man named Will Denson. Fortunately, they only came close. Denson, who had represented union people against the corporations, came up against Percy and other defenders of business interest in court and was known to be a very good shot. He practiced with his pistol every morning, squeezing off 50 rounds with each hand every morning in downtown Birmingham. And he also won most of his cases. Intimidating as Denson was, Walker Percy's father that's having the duel was a very prominent lawyer in Birmingham who represented a lot of the corporate interest. And obviously he and Wild Bill got into a lot of disputes in court. After a particularly heated confrontation, the two decided to settle the matter with pistols. On an appointed morning, they drove to the country and found a secluded spot. Percy asked for a chance to practice. Denson consented. Percy lined up 6 pine cones and blasted away, 6 hits. In this one respect, at least, Leroy was not like his father. He was a very good shot. Denson then asked to take the same practice shots. Percy could not very well refuse. 6 hits, dead and true. Percy then destroyed 6 more pine cones, and again Denson followed suit. The warm-up rounds apparently had a conciliatory effect. Quote, clearly, we're both too good with these things to be doing this, said Percy. Denson agreed, and they returned to their cause, and still enemies, but with much more respect for each other. That'll give you a little background on Wild Bill. And he obviously had a lot of enemies, especially in the legal profession. And the trial started on a Thursday. The courtroom was packed, federal court. And I've never heard of a judge doing this, but the judge let lawyers sit around inside the rail when they didn't have enough chairs, and the courtroom was packed, and they let them open the doors. And for 2 days, it was a packed courtroom. And I guess they came to see the Dream Team defense, but also to see if Wild Bill got his comeuppance and go into prison. Count one, he was indicted in April of 1918. Which was a month before the Sedition Act, and put on trial in July 1918, a month after the Sedition Act was passed. Count one of the indictment stated, he did willfully and knowingly cause mutiny or insubordination or refusal of duty among the military and naval forces. And count two was he attempted to do the same. So it would seem to be fairly easy to convict someone of the attempt to do that. The plan of the defense was strictly to show that all the statements he made, and they were pretty inflammatory, as we'll get into, against Wilson, would clearly be a violation of the Sedition Act. But what the defense was, don't convict a man for saying things that was lawful to say at the time he said them. As I said, my grandfather was the chief counsel, and he had been chairman of the Democrat delegation that went to the National Convention from Alabama and renominated Wilson for a second term, primarily on the basis that he kept us out of war. So I think that's one reason my grandfather was willing to defend Wild Bill, because I think that he felt betrayed by Wilson in violating his campaign promise to keep us out of war. Now, here's the statement that finally got Bill indicted. Might mention, you'll see in the book by Peterson and Fite, that there were various organizations of citizens that were created by the Justice Department and sanctioned by the Justice Department to spy on American citizens and turn them in to the authorities. And I feel sure that's what happened, because Bill made no public speeches. All of these are private conversations he's having with individuals that he knows. Some of them are alleged clients, I think, they were put up to entrap him. But he was sitting in a restaurant during a trial at lunch, and there were many lawyers present, and someone began to be critical of Congressman Huddleston from Birmingham, who had voted against the Selective Service Act. And as the criticism mounted, Bill began to defend Huddleston for his action. And then Bill said he thought the act was unconstitutional himself and should never have been passed. And someone at the table became very angry with him and stated that anybody that defended Huddleston should be afraid of being arrested. So Bill told him that he had no fear of that because you had a constitutional right to either praise or criticize public officials, and you had a duty to do so. And then he stated, quote, "I might go out and criticize the president himself and say he's a traitor and ought to be hung, and the law could not touch me." Little did he know. So I think that's the statement that first got to the U.S. attorney and got him indicted in April of 1918. At the trial, there were 22 witnesses against him. And Mr. Scribbler testified that Bill stated on another occasion, quote, "To hell with the president. He should be hung to a lamppost," end quote. Mr. M.P. Smith said he heard Bill say in a private conversation, "The only reason the United States entered the war was to get back money loaned to the Allies," end quote. Jack Bell heard Denson say in April 1918, quote, "The United States had no business in this war, and if people had stayed off the ships, they would not have been sunk," end quote, because he's talking about the Lusitania there. Mr. Riley Logan stated he heard Bill state in a private conversation, quote, "I would support the government if it was fighting for the right cause, but this war is not being fought for the right cause." A Judge Walker said that Bill advised some of his clients to fill out questionnaires for the draft and told them to claim all exemptions allowed by the law. A Fred Fite, a candidate at the aviation field in Texas, was coming through Birmingham, and on the way to Washington, he stated he went to Bill for advice on a matter, and during the discussion stated, quote, Bill stated, "President Wilson got us into this war, and we have no right to be in this war." Several witnesses said they heard Bill state, quote, "Wilson was elected on a peace platform, and he turned into a traitor. He ought to be hanged, and I, for one, would be glad to see it." Another person stated that there was a discussion at another dinner conversation about the McLemore Resolution in Congress, which had warned Americans to stay off ships going into the danger zones of England. And Bill stated that he had supported the McLemore Resolution and thought it was an excellent thing, and the crowd reacted very strongly against him on that. Another witness said that he was a client and went to Bill for advice and asked if under the U.S. Constitution could an American citizen be compelled to go to France and fight their war. And Bill advised him just to claim all the exemptions possible under the draft. And the man stated that he would be willing to fight to defend America, but saw no reason to go to France and fight their war. Bill did not advise him not to go and didn't advise him to try to avoid the draft. I think this is part of the entrapment. I think that the U.S. attorney got various people to go to him. I can't imagine a real client going and asking for this kind of advice. So I think they were sending people in there and trying to get Bill to advise him not to go or to avoid the draft or do something like that. And then he would clearly have been guilty under the Espionage Act if they had not gone, if they'd taken that advice. But the thing that really endeared me to Bill was his own defense. He got up and testified. Now, he's not one I'm sure that you could coach, and he's got all these great lawyers there to advise him, but he takes his own defense and gets up and testifies and says some things that no lawyer would ever advise him to do. But he said, quote, "I've criticized President Wilson because he was elected on a peace platform under the promise he would keep America out of the war. He departed from his platform and violated his promise to the people. He could have kept us out of this war, and he could have kept his promise, but he didn't. A man elected on a peace platform and then immediately goes and is elected and goes to Congress and asks for war, then he is a traitor to the people. I criticized him for doing that, and a man had a constitutional right to criticize the president at the time I stated that. I was not critical of the government or of Congress or the military, just the president. I had a brother in the Army who was a colonel and had been in the Army for 24 years. My first cousin, Nim Denson, that's my father, was already in France getting ready to go into the trenches. So I had no reason to say anything that would hurt my kin who were in the Army getting ready to fight. My criticism was strictly of the president." Then here's the statement that he volunteers without anybody asking him, and that I really thought it was, this is sensational. He said, "I still think all of those things right now, but I wouldn't say them since they've passed the Sedition Act." That's what you always advise a client, saying, "Now don't volunteer anything, you know, and maybe they'll think you've changed your mind or you regret having said it." And he didn't back off a bit. "I still think it. I just don't see it since they passed the Sedition Act." Well, in the final arguments, Ralph Quinn was a U.S. attorney. He opened by making the argument that the president did not declare war, that Congress declared it. And he stated further that violations of international law by the Germans led America to getting into the war. Of course, that's, I guess, submarine warfare. Sinking ships that are supposed to be passenger ships but are loaded with weapons. He said, now here's this argument that was used in the Milligan case. He says there's a difference in the interpretation of free speech privilege under the Constitution in times of peace and in times of war. And he is, in effect, saying that the Constitution, constitutional protection for free speech is suspended during wartime. That was part of his jury argument. He said the necessity of severe discipline in time of war affects the ability to speak out against the war. He said the authority and the esteem vested in the president as commander-in-chief of the Army should not be attacked in time of war. And then my grandfather got up and argued that he is indicted only for interfering with the operation of the military under the Espionage Act, and that the law at the time that he was indicted allowed a person a constitutional protection to criticize the president, and that he should not be convicted for making statements that were lawful at the time he said them. The jury went out at 8 o'clock on Friday. They kept them together in the hotel, and then they came back at noon on Saturday and found him not guilty. They could easily have convicted him, especially after his statement that he said that he had not withdrawn his thoughts. He still thought exactly that same thing about Wilson, and just wasn't saying it anymore. So that is the trial of Wild Bill Denson, and sort of give you a little history of the effect during World War I of dissent and what was going on. So at this time, I'll be glad to entertain any questions that any of you have. Okay, well, I've got these books here. If any of you want to come up and look, Lou. He continued to do well. He remained very controversial. As you can see, he got into a duel with Walker Percy's father 2 years later. And I think that his law practice went down, I think he suffered greatly from it socially. I don't know if that mattered to him or not. One thing that I thought about on this is both of his sons graduated from West Point. I just wondered if that was sort of a reaction to try to compensate for their father's anti-war stance. One of them, Linda, retired as a two-star general, and his son, Bill, Wild Bill's son was named Bill, he went on to Harvard Law School and became a very very good Wall Street trial lawyer. And there's a book written about him. And I knew this Bill pretty well. When I was a graduate student in New York, I used to have dinner with him. But I had heard that he was a prosecutor at Nuremberg. And I was against the Nuremberg trial, so I never brought it up. But he wasn't at Nuremberg. He was at Dachau. He died about 2 years ago. And this is a book about him, Justice at Dachau. And he was the chief prosecutor in the Dachau trials. One famous case he had was he practiced with his father for a short time, and then he went to New York. But he represented the Saturday Evening Post when Bear Bryant sued him for libel. And that's the suit that put the Saturday Evening Post out of business. But the most interesting thing about Bill, I wish I'd known when I was talking to him because I had dinner at his house, his wife was German. He met her while he was prosecuting the Dachau cases. And she was a survivor of Dresden. And she was a small, a teenage girl, I guess, at the time. But she and many other members of their family were escaping the Russians as they were coming and went to Dresden because it was a non-military target. And, of course, the firebombing that went on, and she survived by being in a basement. Most everybody in the house was killed but her. And so she and Bill met and married while he was in Germany. And Bill spoke very highly of his father. I never brought Wild Bill up because at that time I didn't know that much about him. I wish I had known more about Wild Bill. But Bill thought very highly of him and said he was just a fabulous lawyer. But I think that he did suffer from that that trial. And I think that he was not well thought of because he was attacking, you know, suing businesses and very successful at it. So it probably hurt him a great deal. Any other questions? Tom?
John, you know if they used any of the Lincoln administration precedents to justify the Espionage Act or even prosecution of Wild Bill? All this sounds so familiar to what went on during
the administration. Yeah, it does. The only thing I know about the trial is what I read in the Birmingham papers, and they didn't cover it in any great extent. They just gave you the certain highlights of testimony, but they certainly could have used some of that about Lincoln. The thing that's interesting to me about the wartime dissent in Lincoln, there were 30,000 trials that the records are all there. I don't know if any of you have read the book, The Fate of Liberty, by, that's listed in here. The guy's head of the Lincoln Museum was going to try to dispel the thing that Lincoln was trying people unconstitutionally. And he read 13,000 transcripts of trials where people were tried just like Van Landingham and Milligan. And he then makes a statement, I think in the book, Fate of Liberty, that there were 30,000 trials and about a 99% rate of conviction. And these people that were tried by military courts in the North where the courts were open, and those were all held to be, I mean, the one case held that was an unconstitutional act to try people in a military court in a place where the regular courts are still open. So that's 30,000 unconstitutional trials that took place during the Lincoln administration that are well documented if somebody wanted to do some research. Maybe your third book on Lincoln can be the Tom's got another book on Lincoln coming out. It's funny, my wife gets after me about reading so much, and so we took a trip on the Orient Express train trip, and she made me promise I wouldn't bring any books, and so I just I ordered the book they had recommended for the trip, and one was I wrote you about this, When the Whistle Blows, or something like that. It's just about railroad history. And lo and behold, there's a whole chapter on how crooked Lincoln was. As a railroad lawyer, he found out where the railroad was going to go, the Transcontinental Railroad. So he bought the land in 1858 or somewhere around that period of time. Then when he got to be president, they had a law passed that the president could determine where the railroad went. So naturally, he put it on his property. And it's the most flagrant corruption I guess I've ever seen. But the corruption against the war dissent in the Lincoln administration is just awesome. I mean, those trials, that's probably one of the main ways he won re-election in 1864, is the intimidating factor of trying these people on military courts without lawyers, without being no arrest warrant. They just break in your house, take you, put you in a room and convict you and send you to prison. So 30,000 of those, as compared to the Espionage Act, which is just 2,000 trials. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure for me to be back to meet you.